A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
The downward sloping demand curve is the most basic law of economics, isn't it? Nobody could argue that an increase in price is not going to result in a fall in demand. Well, maybe that works at the individual level, but at the aggregate level, at the level at which you know you can actually apply to an economic model, well, then you are in trouble because, as Steve Keane explains today, that law really doesn't exist. It hasn't been proven, it has been disproven, and it is not a sound foundation for understanding how the economy works because it is much more complicated than those first-year textbooks will let on. That is today on the Debunking Economics podcast with Steve Keane. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. Now, when you get down to the root of it, neoclassic economies are wrong from the ground up. I'm sure that's what Steve Keane would say, having spent most of his life trying to argue that point. So let's get right down to the ground level this week. Steve, let's look at how firms work and let's ignore the macro picture for right now. Let's get down to the nitty-gritty of the microeconomic level. And I think a lot of us can relate to how firms work because we've worked for them ourselves or even run them ourselves. So let's start with the demand curve. You know, that graph that shows the relationship between the price of a good and the demand for it. Economists even call this a law, which means we can't dispute it, presumably. Otherwise, we'll go to prison. But this law says when prices...
Even worse, you could be put in the first year economics textbook.
Exactly.
Economics class. That'd be worse than prison.
Or put in the textbook. Yeah, that reminded me of the... That was a Woody Allen book, wasn't it? This short story about this character who finds himself in a book. And they get trapped there forever. Imagine that being.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
It was some of his early writings. Anyway, we're digressing even from the beginning. But look, this law says when prices fall, demand goes up. Any problem with that?
Well, I mean, the idea is that your buyers want to buy less if the price goes up. They want to buy more if the price goes down. And like there's a certain real world logic to that. I mean, you know, we're all looking for specials, and you go and buy a special when a special happens. And if something gets to be cheaper, then you can afford more of it in your budget, so you're more likely to buy more of it. But the funny thing is, this demand curve, which is such an essential part of mainstream economic theory, can't be derived from mainstream economic theory. And this, to me, is the biggest logical hole in conventional economic thinking, because they spend all their time talking, as you said, about the law of demand. And proving that for an individual, if you try to relate the amount that they'll pay to the amount that they buy, then you find a negative relationship. If the price goes up, the amount of individual demands goes down and vice versa. But when they try to derive that at the level of a market, and of course, to derive a market demand curve, you've got to consider not just an isolated consumer, but every consumer in the country. That's your market. When you do it that way, and they try to show that a decreasing price will increase demand, the theory fails.
Even at the individual level, though, you'd be thinking, well, it's not going to work. I mean, if the price of pizza falls, I might eat a bit more pizza, but there's going to be a ceiling on that, irrespective of the price, isn't it? You know, and then
they do talk about the theory just or the elasticity of demand. So they'll say there are some things where the demand is quite price inelastic. For example, I imagine Texans are realizing the electricity demand is fairly price inelastic.
Yeah, well, they would have done, wouldn't they, a few weeks ago when they were having those big storms? Absolutely.
Yeah, $10,000 a kilowatt. There are some things you simply can't do without for any sustained period, and you'll pay anything to get your hands on it. You won't do that in normal times, but if there's a shortage, then bang, you've got to have it or you die. But other stuff, which is so little interest to you in the market, that an increase in price will mean a drastic fall in your demand for it. So you have some things that were very elastic, very others inelastic, and that's a certain amount of realism and real worldism to the concept of market demand and price sensitivity and so on. But the thing which I find quite hilarious, because it just undermines the whole way of thinking, is that when theoreticians try to prove that the demand curve is slopes down in price. So a higher price means a lower quantity, so the slope of the curve you draw is a negative slope. When they try to prove it, they can't. They get any slope at all.
Right.
Any slope at all. They can't prove.
Well, they don't know what it is, or they're saying it's flat, or they're saying it's going the other way. What are they saying?
Well, the actual answer is, if you want to see some polysyllabic words, look at the way economists try to explain this particular finding. It's in even the names of the people who found it as polysyllabic. So it's called the Sonnenschein Mantel de Broglie theorem. Right. How's that for a mouthful?
Yeah, that's good.
Otherwise,
I feel sorry for Andrew Cox who transcribes these podcasts when he come out with stuff like that.
I'll spell it. Thank you, Andrew. But the Sonnenschein Mantel de Broglie theorem was actually first discovered by a guy called Gorman. And I think Gorman's a bit easier to pronounce. Mm. And that was that they have a theory of how individuals decide how much to consume, which takes their income as given, the price of all other commodities as fixed as well, and then they vary the price of one good, and they say, well, what's going to happen if this good gets cheaper or more expensive to your total demand?
Yeah.
And then as part of that, they say, well, it's quite possible what you're buying, let's say, for example, we're looking at is the price of potatoes. And if you're particularly poor, let's say you're an Irish person in the early 1800s, then if potatoes get to be more expensive, that means you can't afford the other stuff. I mean, demand for potatoes actually goes up. This is what they call a Giffen good.
Yeah.
But in general, they say, well, there are some goods where if the price falls, you get two benefits out of a falling price. One is that the relative price is cheaper, so you're more likely to buy more of that good. But the other one is because the price of something you're paying for out of your income has fallen, you've now got a bit of extra effective income you could spend on other goods as well. So there's what they call the substitution effect and the income effect.
Yeah.
And the substitution effect necessarily is negative, but the income effect can be positive. So they go through quite a bit of rigmarole to finally get to what they call, and this is another, sorry, Andrew, Hicksian compensated demand curves. And this was John Hicks, again, somebody who's been both famous and infamous in economics, said that, well, what we can do is we're trying to see how much a person is going to buy given the relative prices, and we want to focus on the relative prices alone. So we need to get rid of the income effect that can happen from prices getting cheaper.
Yeah.
So his mechanism was, they had used, you know, I won't try to talk this stuff through. It's much more stuff to look at in a diagram. But they have this idea of showing combinations of different sorts of goods that give you exactly the same overall satisfaction. And they call that an indifference curve. And what Hicks said is, well, if you just work out the slope of the indifference curve, that is necessarily negative. This is just the substitution effect. The cheaper something gets, the more of it you can buy. And with the substitution effect alone, you necessarily will buy more if the price falls. So that's what they do at the individual level. But then,
which is nonsense, of course. But we'll come back to it.
We'll come back to that. A whole lot of stuff is nonsense about their theories. But this particular bit is a fitting piece of nonsense.
The reason I think it's nonsense is, so say you've got pizza and Chinese food, then if the price of pizza falls, then relatively speaking, the price of the Chinese food is increased. And so that by that logic, then I'd say, well, okay, that makes the Chinese food seem more expensive. Therefore, I'm going to eat less Chinese food because pizza prices have fallen. But what happens if I actually quite like Chinese food and I've got more money because I'm not spending as much on pizza?
Well, that's what they call the income effect. Mm. And that's what there's some goods where, you know, the fall in price can encourage you to spend that money elsewhere rather than spend on that particular good.
But the substitution argument is also saying, you know, you're looking at the relativity of it. So the fall in the price of pizza has made the Chinese food seem more expensive to you. But it's not. It's the same price as it was before. I don't care.
Yeah. But it's, you know, the economics is all about, you know, neoclassical economics is all about relative prices. So they obsess about this one. But what they've got in their theory is they don't talk about workers and capitalists and bankers, which, you know, I do in my both my language and my modeling. But they simply talk about the individual. They leave out the question of where your income comes from. And with the very basic level of how they look at the economy, they focus upon this isolated individual, the classic Robinson Crusoe, and they leave out the class relationship. Now, a class relationship only exists if there are social classes. You can only talk about workers as a social class, if there's another class of non-workers we call capitalists or we call bankers. So there's at the core of the old classical school of economic thought, there was a way in which the distribution of income was part of their thinking. But with the neoclassicals, they said, forget all this stuff, doesn't matter how you make your money, we're all individuals, except for me, of course. I'm telling you, if that was a Monty Python reference.
Yeah, that's all right.
Don't yeah, that's right. Thank you. Good. Just seeing if you're awake. This is neoclassical economics, so you could easily fall asleep while I'm talking. but the idea is that they completely leave out you. You have no. They don't even consider your relation with anybody else at all, let alone whether you're in a social class or not. So you're just an isolated individual with an income source, which then again, the theory doesn't care. You know, when they work out the demand curve, they're not saying how much of this income is from profit and how much is from wages. It's just that's your income that we take as fixed. Then we take all other prices as being fixed. We vary one price and we see what happens. And with a few shenanigans, we can derive a downward sloping individual demand curve. But then and this is where, you know, I have some respect for some of these mathematical economists who've done this work. They then said, well, that works for an individual because you're seeing an individual in isolation. You're looking at a single commodity in isolation. Mm. You're working out those two relationships. What about driving a market demand curve? Can you just look at that individual in isolation? No, you've got to look at everybody who's effectively part of the market. And therefore, you're looking at the market for potatoes in Ireland, then you're looking at the entire population of Ireland, including those who produce potatoes.
Yeah. Yep.
So if you then talk about changing the price of potatoes, I hate the fact that I've got in potatoes as an example, but it'll have to do.
apologies to the Irish listening for you being stereotyped.
And for those people who don't like potatoes.
And for those people, exactly.
But if you increase the price of potatoes, you make potato buyers wealthier.
Mm.
Okay. Now, they're part of the demand for potatoes. If it happens, what's the alcohol you make out of potatoes?
Vodka, isn't
it? Vodka, there you go. Well, let's just say all these Irish people happen to be great fans of vodka. So the increase in the price of potatoes makes them wealthier. Mm. They've got more money to spend. They buy more vodka. And what can happen out of all that is that the income distribution effects, which you cannot get rid of as you can for an individual using this theory, that income effect can outweigh the substitution effect, and the increase in price for potatoes can cause an increase in demand for potatoes. And the way that if anybody's done economic theory and they've suffered through working out indifference curves, the way that I make the point about this is they to get the idea of a downward sloping demand curve, they treat the point on the vertical axis, which is where your income and all other goods turn up, as fixed. And then they change the angle of the line you can draw from there to how, if you spend all your income buying potatoes, how many potatoes could you buy? That's the number on the x-axis. So that varies as you change the price of potato. The vertical one remains fixed. With a few shenanigans, you can guarantee you get a downward sloping demand curve for potatoes. But once you say the income is changed and affected by the change in relative prices, that fixed point on the vertical axis becomes mobile. And therefore, when you start doing all your attempts to join up and draw an overall market demand curve where some people's demand's going up and others is going down, that point can go all over the...
No.
Should I swear again? All the over the place. And you can get any curve you can draw, which is a curve where, rather than being a downward sloping demand curve, you get a curve which can be you can draw by running your finger along the page in one direction, never crossing back on your path and never intersecting, and that can be a demand curve. And it's in mathematical terms, any continuous function, and that's the word they use,
so what's
is
the,
a demand
So what's
curve.
The law then at the end of all now, of this then? So the law is – so I was going to
well,
say –
there ain't
the,
no
so
law.
The law is
there ain't
that
no, it's lawless.
Demand falls as the price goes up unless it doesn't. Is that we can say that, can't we? That would be about as much as we can say.
Well, no, you can say demand falls as the price goes up unless it rises.
Or stays the same.
Both of which are equally feasible at the aggregate level. So what it means is the theory is a mess. And the response to that should have been, and this is where a good friend of mine, Alan Kerman, now a good friend, we became, Alan and I met in a funny way. Alan Kerman wrote a wonderful paper on the economic theory, and the subtitle was "The Emperor Has No Clothes." Well, you might remember that's when I had the Debunking Economics, I subtitled it "The Naked Emperor of the Social Sciences," and Alan made the point that looking at this theory, the only way to get out of it was to work at a high level of aggregation, because the whole problem is it's ignoring the distribution of income. Now, if you change relative prices, you change income distribution. If you make potatoes more expensive, you make potato producers wealthier, potato consumers in general poorer, and you really don't know which way the overall pattern's going to go. The only way to be able to get a definitive answer out of it is to include social classes in there and to say, well, you know, even in terms of like industrial structure as well, of course.
But even they're not fixed. They're going to be changed by the model as well, as people move from one class to another as they become wealthier because potatoes have gone up. So
yeah, but there's not the less social mobility in the human classes than you might expect, or maybe as much as you would expect. But the end result is the whole idea of trying to derive economics from the isolated individual and working up, which is the foundation of neoclassical economics, fails at the very first post, because if they do that, they can't even derive a market demand curve. They've got to assume, they've got to make ad hoc assumptions. And this is, if you want to annoy a neoclassical, accuse them of making ad hoc assumptions. And they'll say, oh, no, we don't. We're pure theorists. We go back to the foundations and derive everything from, what are they called fundamental parameters. They'll use terms like that. But the reality is, to even make their theory of the demand curve work, they've got to make arbitrary assumptions to get it. And the arbitrary assumption they make is a classic. And the way it was first expressed by the guy who first discovered this guy called Gorman back in 1953, he actually said the following summary: the necessary conditions quoted above are quite intuitively reasonable. They say, in effect, that an extra dollar of income will be spent in the same manner, no matter to whom it is given.
So, me and Rupert, absolutely. Give us 10
quid. No, I think Elon's a better. Let's use Elon again. Elon too. Okay. You get an extra dollar and you will spend 50 pence of that in establishing an outpost on Mars. It's obvious, isn't it?
That's absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's total effing nonsense.
My wife keeps on giving me a hard time over that. Yeah, I know.
I've seen all those red balls in your
study. The kids are starving and there you are off on your moon project again, a Mars project again.
Yeah.
So it is crazy. It is simply crazy. This is what neoclassicals do all the time. They reach a logical impasse and they leap over it with a ludicrous assumption, which they are happy with because it means they don't need to worry about it anymore, but it makes a travesty of their whole theory. And then yet on they continue. So they can't even explain where a market demand curve comes down, which has the characteristics they want, unless they assume that all consumers have close to identical tastes. There's only one way the tastes can differ. And all commodities are identical as well. That's the fun bit. Because the way that Gorman put this, first of all, is to say that all Engels curves are parallel. Now, Engels does not mean Karl and Marx here. It's a mathematical term for Engels, but the Engel curve is the curve you can draw by increasing somebody's income without changing prices. And that students will go through exercises using the stuff we used to when I was a victim of a first year economics class. And a luxury good is one which you will spend more of as your income rises. A necessity is one you'll spend less of. Now, the class of good that their theory fits is neither a luxury nor a necessity. It's a good which you consume in exactly the same ratio of your income, no matter how much your income rises. But let's take an example, for example, pizza. You mentioned pizza beforehand. Mm. How many pizzas do you reckon Bill Gates consumes?
Well, by that theory, he'd be eating an awful lot, wouldn't he?
And billions of them a week.
He looks so slim on it. He's tired. Yeah, yeah. I'd like to know what his secret is, given
his secret is not being a neoclassical economist. it's nonsense that there's this constant curve, but that's what they were willing to assume to hang on to the theory. Yeah. And what they should have done is realize, well, first of all, the whole idea of starting from isolated individuals doesn't work. We've got to work at some aggregate level, which is what the classical school of economics did before they came along. And I've actually lost in my second point saying my firstly, but also admit that a lot of the exchanges are non-equilibrium exchanges. The whole thing they're trying to do is shove everything into an equilibrium.
Well, you've got to have that equilibrium because we've got to have that point, haven't we? In our first year textbooks where we're saying, prices rise as, we see the cross between the two, diminishing marginal utility equals,
Marginal cost.
Rising marginal cost, the cost of production. So,
which is the next myth we'll talk about in the next installment.
So without that, how do we get at the optimum price? it'll be
and
left
that's exactly
to,
it, yeah.
It'll be left to businesses to decide that all by themselves, which when I was running a business, if I saw that demand was increasing, the first thing I'd do would be to push up prices. It really is a factor of how much competition have you got. But also the uniqueness of your product as well, which, you know, you can't, just as you can't assume that every individual behaves the same, you can't assume that every single pizza is the same, for example.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, the way they've made a whole set of assumptions to lock us into a vision of competition, which bears almost no relation to the real world of competition. So you were talking in telecommunications, I take it, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Even in telecommunications, there are different bit rates, different frequency bands, different hardware, different operating systems, and so on.
But also difference of how you present your brand. There's difference in your customer service. Yeah. You know, there's customer's perception of your company.
So, and that's what tends to determine competition. It's not competing over relative price. It's relative features that drives competition, and that's the interesting stuff. That is quite fascinating, and I know, like the marketing world and management world will spend a lot of time on that issue. But economists boil it down to just being relative price and poo-pooing the importance of different quality aspects of the same product class and so on. And they've produced this soulless form of vision of competition, which isn't internally consistent anyway. And that's the farce of it all. So I just want to kick the whole bloody lot out and start looking at it in sort of a management marketing way that you're talking about it as well. Corporations don't compete, generally speaking, on price. They compete on effectively quality or unique characteristics of the product. And marketing and so on, and that's an essential part of a capitalist economy. Let's try to understand
even it. If you were looking at it as if every company was producing exactly the same, so the marginal utility to the consumer, you know, the utility, I should say, to the consumer from everyone's product is exactly the same, you're going to have different sized firms, aren't you, within that industry, all with, you know, different costs of production. So you know, that supposed supply and demand curve is going to cross at the wrong place for many companies.
That's the thing to talk about.
That's a high cost of production.
That's a topic for the next half, where they're talking about the demand curve today. But yeah, all these things that are an essential part of the real world are assumed away by neoclassical economics. And what they've done is assume away the interesting stuff. The stuff that actually gives you change over time. So, like in terms of competition, how do you get new products coming about? What is Lamborghini famous for?
Making cars, not toasters.
What was it first? What is it first manufactured?
Oh, you might have told me this before. I don't know.
Yeah, tractors.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Tractors. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah.
So it was actually competition between the Lamborghini and Ferrari families to build a fast car to appeal to their fellow wealthy capitalists in the north of Italy. That's what led to the development of these incredible high-performance vehicle companies.
Boring watching tractors going around the Monaco Grand Prix circuit, wouldn't it?
I think that's actually how they started tractor races. So, but yeah, that's the fascinating stuff about how does innovation occur and how do new products turn up, and that evolutionary side of capitalism is its strength. This is what capitalism does better than any pre-existing social system. It's innovating variations in products and technological change over time, and that's all completely left out of the mainstream economic thinking. It's all about relative prices. There's no real concept of innovation turning up in any meaningful sense in their theory, and they fill people's heads full of all this competitive stuff. End up defending a world which doesn't exist and using it as a way to talk about the strengths of the one we actually live in, to which those features don't actually apply.
Right. But given that, you know, in that first year of economics, that you are told the supply and demand curve and here is the price of pizza, how is that actually, even though it might be wrong, does it really matter? How is it really applied? Now, has anyone ever actually used those supply and demand curves in any real life situation? I mean, does it feed into models anywhere? I mean, is it used at all?
I think there are some people who do calculations, elasticity and so on. So that actually does turn up what is the impact, generally speaking, of us changing our price on the demand for our product.
Right. But that's fair enough, isn't it? I mean, ideally,
you'd say,
let's segment it. Let's look, because there'll be different elasticities that based on, I mean, as a marketer, that's what I do. I'd say, well, okay, we believe the 6 market segments. Let's look at the price elasticity per segment and see how much overall it's going to impact us, but it's applying that same rule, isn't it? So the theory is sound.
Yeah, it's okay at that level, but they've spent far too much time on it, And the whole idea of like market demand curve and market supply curves are mathematical abstractions anyway. And for most firms, the basic story is whatever the elasticity, you sell as many units as you can. We're simply trying to find the price competitive features combination that gives us as much market share as we can get our hands on. And that's what tends to drive individual firms.
Right. So the supply curve then, supposed to slope the other way. You're going to tell me that that doesn't apply either because there's too many factors.
I am, but not this week because I think we've already pretty much exhausted our time. But I'm going to give you a couple of quotes of my favourite.
We've been talking for 24 minutes, which is we normally talk for.
I'm going to quote a bit of Samuelson here.
Cool. All right, that's okay. Yeah.
Okay, good, because
We don't want two lines in one podcast, obviously.
Well, yeah, but you need one curve in one, the other. Let's keep the curve neatly separated, just like neoclassical theory does.
Dear listener, is why we've done almost 250 episodes of this podcast. We can really drag it out if we want to.
We can slice and dice, yeah.
We'll look at the intersection between these two curves. We don't want to do that in the same episode, do we?
That could actually seriously be a way we go. I'm not joking.
Okay, Samuelson.
Samuelson, because I read textbooks. I'm actually reading at the moment Mankiw's textbook again and Bormal and Blinder's textbook to have a go at the theory of the supply curve, which we'll talk about in the next installment. But my favorite, that we're talking about demand curve here, the fact that this theory didn't work, so you couldn't derive a market demand curve, is something they gloss over in the textbooks. They'll wave their hands about it and say, what we've done with the individual applies at the market level, and boom, here's the market demand curve, and then on to the next page. And there's no serious mention of it. Much to my amazement, somebody sent me saying, well, Samuelson says he's actually proven that the market demand curve has exactly the same characteristic as the individual demand curve. And here's the quote. This is page 234 of, I think, the 2012 or 15 edition of Samuelson's textbook. The market demand curve is found by adding together the quantities demanded by all individuals at each price. Does the market demand curve obey the law of downward sloping demand? It certainly does. Okay? Nice and emphatic. It certainly does. And then I went, where the hell did he draw this from? Because I know that's a lie. Did he actually think he proved it? And I went searching and found a paper in 56 by Samuelson where, yes, he proved that the market demand curve slopes down just like individual. How did he prove it? Well, he first of all said that you can't go from an individual demand curve to a country's demand curve, but you can go from an individual demand curve to a family demand curve if you assume, and wait, this is going to love, I've got to read this whole thing out. Since blood is thicker than water, the preferences of the different members are interrelated by what might be called a consensus or social welfare function. This is, I'm sure, how you handle your kids' pocket money, mate, which takes into account the deservedness or ethical worths takes into account the deservedness or ethical worths of the consumption levels of each of the members, the family acts as if it were maximizing their, and that's a busy word, their joint welfare function. In other words, you and Dana and the kids get together, pool all the money, share it out till everybody's equally happy about the distribution of income, and then you go shopping.
Mm.
Okay.
Sadly, that
your family works that way, doesn't it?
Sadly, it does. Rather too much.
Absolutely.
In my
liking. Okay. Now, wait for it. Punchline. That's working out. So you can sort of say, okay, so he's assuming all families are happy. We don't have any war and peace families in the list. So just all happy families.
Thanks to the wonders of economics. How do you get to society from that? Well, just on that. That means, just I'm just looking at that. If one behavior is replicated by the whole of the family, then grandma's in incontinence pads, then everyone's in incontinence pads.
Not quite. No, grandma gets her pads, and she gets as many pads as you get scotches.
Right.
Okay. But so the same argument will apply to all of society. And I've got to read this out slowly. If optimal reallocations of income can be assumed to keep the ethical worth of each person's marginal dollar equal.
So I thought economics was all about that we all acted in our own interests. But now we're actually saying, we're acting in the good of society as a whole.
Because we know this doesn't work, therefore we have installed, and we all know this person, of course, a benevolent central authority, perhaps, above us that redistributes income before any of us go shopping so that all of us are happy. I'm very happy about Rupert Murdoch's share of UK national income, and I'm sure he's very happy about mine. Literally, he assumed that all of America is one big happy family. And, you know, you think I'm being sarcastic. This is how it's quoted in the leading textbook. This is the sort of garbage of what I read through, which is what I really resent neoclassical economists with a passion these days. This is the book called Maskelel, which is the textbook used by all the PhD programs, or certainly in America and mostly around the world. So he goes through this section in his textbook. He says, let us now hypothesize that there is a process. Wait for it. A benevolent central authority, perhaps, that for given any given prices P, like a vector of prices, an aggregate wealth function W, redistributes wealth in order to maximize social welfare. So they assume America is a socialist dictatorship, and therefore the market system works in a socialist dictatorship.
Wow.
I haven't heard you being silent for that long ever.
No, I'm just saying Joe Biden's got a lot of work to do, hasn't he? I mean, he might be heading in the right direction. Perhaps he's reading the
same. Joe, they've finally got the benevolent dictator. This is the nonsense they go on with to hang on to their bloody theories, which is why I get so angry about this crap, because it's this lovely superficial veneer of a well-oiled machine, and you go inside it and it makes Heath Robinson look like a genius.
So we are up to 30 minutes now, so we can go, and work on the next curve next week. But, I mean, so all we can say, I mean, it's for very basic level economics, day one, it's still worth showing the demand curve, isn't it? Even though we say, but this is just for one.
Not really.
This is for one person at one point in time. It really doesn't apply in the real world, and here's why. It's a good.
Well, we haven't even talked about why their model of individual behavior doesn't fit an individual. That's another topic. We should actually wrap in. That's a guy called a German academic called Sippel. I've never actually met him. I would like to meet up with him. This is nothing. Good.
Can you do it in three minutes? Can you tell us about Sippel in 3 minutes? Go on, give it a go.
No. Oh, well, okay. Basically, Sippel tried to prove the theory of the individual consumer to his class. He had a class of, I think he had a tutorial group of about 12 people and then a large group of about 35. And he decided to do an experiment testing the theory of consumer behavior, which was due to Samuelson, by the way, called the theory of revealed preference. And Samuelson, people were attacking the whole idea of the way he is, again, Samuelson's invention of indifference curves to represent taste. So you work out this combination of goods to which you're indifferent, and that gives you a set of points where you get the same utility. So if you change your relative price and stay on that curve, you feel no better off or worse for changing your consumption. Mm. And people said, well, we can't see these things. And Samuelson said, aha, we can reveal them by asking people questions that show whether they're on the same indifference curve or a different one. And the axioms are transitivity. So if you prefer A to B and B to C, you prefer A to C. Completeness. So if you're shown one bundle of goods and another bundle of goods, you can say which one you prefer, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And what Sippel did was set up a set of eight repeated experiments with students over a substantial period of time where they were given different relative price combinations for each of these eight types of commodities, which tested various elements of this theorem. And when he finished doing it, he found 95% of the answers he got contradicted the theory with the 12. So he repeated it, and with the larger group, he got, I think, 92% of the answers contradicted the theory. And the reason it fell over, people could certainly say whether they preferred chips to orange juice and a different price of orange juice would mean they buy different, more oranges and less chips and so on, all this sort of stuff. But what the theorem falls over on is what's known as the curse of dimensionality. Because if you just imagine you have like 10 commodities, which you're looking at, 10 different commodities, and 10 different quantities from 0 to 10, you have 10 to the 10 combinations, okay? That is so many combinations that you're given, if you want to make a whole bunch of shopping trolleys with different combinations you can make out of that, you've got a billion combinations.
And I'm sure, for each category, he was only choosing
a billion shopping trolleys.
He was only choosing one brand as well. So, you know.
Well, the brands didn't even come into it.
Yeah, they multiply many times over as well, because you might decide that you don't want a fizzy drink unless it's Coke.
Yeah. So Sippel tried all sorts of very valiant ways to rescue the theory. And at the end of it, he said, realizing that we can't even explain consumer demand, maybe we should reduce our economists should reduce their imperialistic pressure to try to take over other social sciences. So I think he in trying to prove the theory and ending up disproving it, he had a realistic reaction to it and said it just doesn't work. And unfortunately, that theory that doesn't work is still taught in every textbook in economics.
So what is page one then? What do we teach kids in the first hour of learning economics? What's our opening sentence? If we're not going to do this supply and demand curve, what do we start with?
Well, you're going to find that when I start talking about the context of the new week. Economics a manifesto.
All right, okay.
But I start with the banking. I start with money.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Good point. Okay. Very good. Mm. All right. Well, we'll look next week. Obviously next week, because everyone's hanging out for it now. Next week, we're going to look at the supply curve. And
there you go.
And maybe the week after, unless we can get through it next week, if we really put a spurt on, maybe we can look at the intersection between the two.
There you go.
We'll see how we manage. All right, very good to talk, Steve. Thank you.
Welcome, mate. Bye.
And now you understand why this podcast could last for years, couldn't it? That's it for today, and it probably will. That's it for today. I'm Phil. I'll be back with Steve Keen again next week. Thanks for listening.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.